From WABE in Atlanta, this is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thanks for joining us for our daily look at the arts and culture of Atlanta and the creative minds at the helm. Today, we'll be thinking about representation. We'll hear how Atlanta residents are seeing the spirit of their neighborhood reflected in the public art project Urban Fronts. World-renowned designer Debbie Millman will be in studio to talk about how text and language define our reality. And first ahead, a new film on the longest witch hunt in American history. The Atlanta Jewish Film Festival has partnered with Out On Film for a special screening of The Lavender Scare. That documentary is the first to detail the 1950s campaign by the United States government to identify and fire all employees suspected of being homosexual. We have the film's director, Josh Howard, here in studio with us, along with the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival's Chris Holland and Out On Film's Jim Farmer. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Josh, this is a very impressive and most disturbing documentary. And you worked on it for a very long time. What led you to create it?
Well, I stumbled upon a book called The Lavender Scare. I had thought I knew about American history, about the McCarthy era. But I just happened to come across this book that told the story of the government's systematic effort that began in the 1950s and continued for decades to identify and remove gay men and lesbians from the federal workforce. And it was just a fascinating story. And the characters who were described in the book were getting on in years, and I just wanted to preserve their stories on film.
And we should add, Josh's background is most impressive. I have to say it because he has 24 Emmy Awards to his credit. This man knows something about producing and filmmaking. And I wondered why this was the first documentary on the Lavender Scare. Why do you think it hadn't been explored on film before?
Well, it was also the first book written about the Lavender Scare. Terrific historian David Johnson began work in the 1990s on this subject. It's a story that has never been told because while it was going on, there was really a conspiracy of silence on both sides. The gay men and lesbians who were being fired didn't want to talk about why they were driven out of their jobs because they were indeed in the closet and they wanted to keep their sexuality a secret because they, you know, needed other jobs and homosexuality was not accepted in the 1950s. So they didn't talk about why they were fired. And the government, after an initial burst of publicity, as this systematic effort went on for really several decades, the government didn't want to talk about how many people were getting fired, because the question would then be, well, why did you hire them in the first place? So neither side really discussed this, and it's not until David Johnson started his research. A lot of government documents had been newly declassified in the 1990s. He was the first person to actually put together the overall picture of how the government systematically went about this.
One of the facts brought out in the film very effectively is that before the Lavender Scare, before the early 50s, it seems that openly gay people in the 1920s and 30s were at least discriminated against less, if not more accepted by society. What was happening then?
Well, I think that's such an interesting message of the film, that really the homophobia and discrimination of the 1950s was a direct backlash against that earlier time when homosexuality was more accepted by society. You know, there was the Great Depression in the 30s and World War II in the 40s, and people were more focused on more practical issues of living their lives than worrying about how other people were living theirs. And it was really in the 1950s that there was a conservative backlash against that.
And before that conservative backlash in the early 50s, World War II broke out. What impact did that have on gay life? Jim? Well, Josh?
Absolutely. It was one of the historians in the film describes World War II as the most revolutionary thing that happened to gay men and lesbians. And the reason was that with the draft and people volunteering to serve, millions of Americans were mobilized, and those who did enlist found themselves in same-sex environments and were able to, in many cases, connect with other gay people for the first time in their lives. They'd come from small towns where they were isolated, might have thought they were the only gay people, but being in the service gave them that opportunity. It also created influx of people into metropolitan areas and created the opportunity to build gay communities in that way.
I mean, that part of it was very heartening. Here, people just trying to serve their countries dutifully, and then also discovering others like themselves and minding their own business when not working.
Well, during World War II, the government needed bodies, and the military did not go out of its way to, throw out gay men and lesbians. They wanted people to fight. It was only after the war that the government and the military then began to weed out homosexuals with a vengeance.
Mm. Out on Film kicks off in 2 weeks. And the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival doesn't begin until the winter of 2018. Why have these occasional programs, such as this screening of The Lavender Scare? What does this do for a festival?
5 years ago, Out on Film started year-round programming, and we've been pretty aggressive about it this year. And I know that the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival has recently started as well. I know for us, it allows us to really show films throughout the year versus, an eight-day period. And it's a great way to keep your name out there and show films like this that might not have been available during the time of your festival. Mm-hmm. So I love being able to show films like this. And to be able to collaborate with the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival is wonderful. It's a wonderful opportunity. Collaborating with other arts organizations in town really gives you an opportunity to bring your audience and their audience together, and nothing really brings community together as art does. It's a great opportunity.
Yeah, we're following Jim's lead with the year-round programming, just starting that this year. And I think every so often you strike on a film like this one that the Venn diagram of the audience that's interested overlaps so much that it's a natural fit. Mm-hmm. And we're extremely grateful for the support that our base has shown to us and has shown to this film. And there's a segment of our base that is also Jim's base, and we want those people to come out. We want more people in our base who aren't in that camp to see more about Out on Film, and to be aware that it's there. And just as the Jewish Film Festival welcomes everyone, it's their films, not just Jewish films, they're for everybody. Sometimes our audience needs to be reminded that the same is true of Out on Film. Mm-hmm. They're not just gay and lesbian films, they're awesome films.
Exactly. This is a perfect film to collaborate on. I mean, I really think this is a perfect collaboration this time around.
If you are just joining us, I'm speaking with The Lavender Scare director Josh Howard, along with the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival's Chris Holland and Jim Farmer of Out on Film. We'll be back in a moment.
Support for WABE comes from Theater Emory, presenting Midnight Pillow, inspired by Mary Shelley, directed by Park Crowson. September 21st through October 1st in the Schwartz Center Theater Lab. What dreams haunt your Midnight Pillow? Info at theater.emory.edu. And from Reliable Heating and Air, a Trane dealer. A family company since 1978, offering heating and air, plumbing, electrical, and duct cleaning 24 hours a day. Learn more at reliableair.com.
You are listening to City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thanks for joining us. I'm here with filmmaker Josh Howard and film festival organizers Chris Holland of the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival and Jim Farmer of Out on Film. The AJFF and Out on Film are presenting Josh's documentary, The Lavender Scare, tonight at Midtown Arts Cinema. It didn't take long after this golden period of World War II for reactionary views to take hold, fomented by Senator Joe McCarthy's work. The campaign was beyond ruthless. I mean, it destroyed lives. It ended some lives. And one aspect of the film that I found especially haunting is the use of interviews with people who carried out these horrible attacks. FBI agents, State Department officers. And the use of language was so startling. Perverts is the acceptable term. I mean, in newspapers, perverts, I guess. This all just reinforces how grateful I feel to have been born when I was born. Not that things are so great now, but so this language, these horrid attacks were on people mostly who were dutifully serving their country. And then there were the appeals to their co-workers and friends to do their patriotic duty, which seems harder for us to grasp now than I guess it must have felt as a moral dilemma for them at the time. But how did the government connect the dots, if you will, from one sexual orientation to being a threat to national security? I mean, it's almost laughable.
Well, there was never any real evidence, but the theory was that gay people were in the closet and wanted to hide their sexuality, and that would make them susceptible to blackmail by foreign government agents. The first part of that was actually true. Gay people did need to remain in the closet. Intimate acts between same-sex couples were illegal throughout the country in those days. And so there was a very practical reason homosexuals didn't want to disclose their sexuality. So the government was right about that. The second part never happened. There was never a single case that the government could identify of a gay man or lesbian being blackmailed by a foreign government into revealing secrets. The irony of the story is that they were being blackmailed, however, by their own government, because government agents would say to gay people who they had identified, give us the names of other gay people who you know so we can go investigate them. And if you don't give us those names, then we're going to expose you. And so a lot of people, you know, some refused and stayed silent, but a lot of people did submit to that pressure to reveal the names of other people.
Please tell us about Frank Kameny.
Frank Kameny was, he's one of a kind. probably 5,000 people had been fired by the government and had gone quietly without any protest before Frank Kameny came along. He was the first person to fight back and resist his firing. He was born in New York. He was educated at Harvard University. He had a PhD in astronomy. This was at the in the early days of the space age, when very few people were as well trained in that field as he was. And he was stubborn, and he believed that he was right, and he fought his dismissal, and he fought it through administrative channels, through the courts. He wrote his own brief to the U.S. Supreme Court. He was turned down every step of the way, and at some point he decided that political activism was the way to make some progress in this area, and he really is now seen as the first person to really radicalize the gay rights movement years before Stonewall.
Yeah, and tell us how he went about it.
Well, he was Frank was responsible for organizing the first pickets, the first gay rights pickets in the country, and it happened at the White House, and it was just his personality and determination that attracted other people, and it's kind of the the silver lining in a way to this story, that it was the discrimination and oppression of the government actions that really created this spark within the gay community that launched the early days of the gay rights movement.
But what he experienced was soul-crushing. I mean, would it have been soul-crushing for others, and was, but it just seemed to motivate him all the more in terms of getting this before the courts. And I think, I don't think this is a spoiler alert. It's one of the great moments of the film. When President Obama recognizes him in 2009 for his work on behalf of civil rights.
Well, it was a remarkable moment for Frank, and so symbolic for the movement. Here was a guy who was thrown out of the government because he was gay, and now, he's being honored by the president. But, you mentioned it could be a soul-crushing moment. Frank's soul could never be crushed, and it really took someone like this to be the first person to fight back. Frank was fond of saying that if he and society disagreed on an issue, he would give that issue careful second thought. He would consider society's opinion. And after that second thought, if he still felt he was right, then in fact he was right and society was wrong. And they better stay out of his way, because he's going to fight for what he believed was right. And he certainly did that.
Speaking of, the true scientific method, or who knows, philosophical method that he wrote, it was interesting to me that in organizing that first picket line outside the White House, that he required those marching to adhere to a dress code. This was not a radical. This was not someone throwing bombs. This was someone who said, if you want to look like you're employable, then dress as though you're employable, according to their standards.
Well, he was a combination of both. It took a radical to picket at that point and to come out as a gay man, but he also understood what the goal was, and he also was pretty strict about things, and he would not let people picket with him unless they were dressed appropriately. As the movement progressed beyond Stonewall into the 1970s, he went from being seen as a radical to, by some people, seen as being too conservative, mm-hmm. because he still was wearing suits and ties. But he continued fighting for gay rights throughout the rest of his life.
Josh, with the FBI involvement, I wondered whether you had considered including anything in the film about J. Edgar Hoover or Roy Cohn, because these names didn't appear, did they?
We did consider it. We really felt that it's an interesting sidelight to the story. And David Johnson, in his book, explores that relationship. But in terms of the film, we really wanted to focus on certainly the people who were fired, but also the government officials who were directly responsible for carrying out the investigations and the firings.
I must mention that the film is a documentary, but it builds with such suspense that it feels a lot like a thriller. I mean, I kept hoping I was going to get through this gruesome chapter to a better ending. And the music is so effective. Would you talk about some of the other elements in the documentary, like the photos and the use? The editing is marvelous.
Well, it was a hard story to make into a film because there was very little newsreel footage of these actual events. So we worked very hard at gathering documents, still photos. We used some sketches at some point. Had a very talented editor and motion design artist, Bruce Shaw, who took these elements and I think was able to visualize the story in a way that's engaging to the audience.
Oh, and the music, it's marvelous, but it's so menacing. I mean, Hitchcock, you know, Bernard Herrmann, it's just marvelous. We have been speaking with the director of the documentary, The Lavender Scare, Josh Howard, along with the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival's Chris Holland, and Out on Films, Jim Farmer. The film will be screened tonight at 7 o'clock at Midtown Art Cinema. Josh, congratulations. And gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
Why must we steal away to steal a kiss or two? Why must we wait to do the things we want to do? Why, oh why, oh why, oh why, oh why? Wish we didn't have to meet. Secretly wish we didn't have to kiss.
Support for WABE comes from the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra. On September 21st and 23rd, Paris comes to Atlanta as megastar Jean-Yves Thibaudet brings his piano pyrotechnics to the ASO's opening weekend. Tickets are on sale now at aso.org. And from Emory Executive Education at Emory's Goizueta Business School. Design thinking for business innovation can help business leaders solve complex problems to drive innovation through the design thinking approach. Working professionals and executives that want to strengthen their leadership and strategy skills often take this two-day short course. This class will be held October 11th and 12th of 2017. More info at worksmarter.org/NPR.
You're tuned to City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. Some Cascade Heights residents want their commercial district to better reflect their neighborhood, and they're accomplishing that through art. The neighborhood has a unique history of racial tension and diverse, or I should say, divisive politics. It was the site of the Peyton Wall Affair of 1962, when Mayor Ivan Allen erected a wall on the corner of Peyton and Harlan Roads. The event had been dubbed Atlanta's Berlin Walls. Despite these setbacks, the neighborhood boasts beautiful homes and parks and is the home of notable Atlantans like Shirley Franklin and Andrew Young. Now, the Cascade Heights neighborhood has its businesses in its sights, and this is where Urban Fronts comes in. It's an initiative by the American Institute of Architects in Atlanta. Essentially, it's an art program where artists create pieces within vacant storefronts. There's also a pop-up gallery reflecting the flavor of the neighborhood. I spoke with Cascade Heights resident, artist, and architect Oscar Harris about the neighborhood, alongside Jessica Nelson, who's organizing this year's Urban Fronts. Curbed Atlanta did a series of articles about Cascade Heights and pointed to an effort to develop a more robust commercial district. Where does that stand now?
That came out of the Cascade Heights Community Development Corporation, which I am a member. We were just tired of the fact that that commercial district looked and appeared the way that it has for so long. No changes, no really redevelopment, but yet around it, we had all these very important people. We had mayors, we had parents of mayors. We had a very affluent group of people, but the commercial district was not reflecting that. So when I pulled up on Curbed and I found out there wasn't hardly anything being written about Cascade Heights, then we started to write. We actually developed some of the writing for that to begin to show interest in the area, because we want the area to grow and want people to come there, and we want it to be as vibrant as any other place in the city.
So bringing Urban Fronts in, it makes sense to have artists create work for storefronts. Could you give us a preview of what some of the artists are planning for those storefronts?
So this year we have a few teams creating storefronts, and one of those storefronts are a team of students from the KSU Architecture Department, and they've designed a three-dimensional piece that you can walk around and kind of interact with. It has different LED lighting, you can change colors, you can actually engage with it.
What are some of the goals of the Urban Fronts program, particularly for this one in Cascade Heights?
Well, our goals are always to bring awareness of design and art to the general public. And specifically this year, it was to occupy storefronts that had, like Oscar said, been in disrepair, I guess, in a way, for a long time, and bring attention back to a part of Atlanta that's been greatly overlooked.
Of course, some of the biggest concerns in Atlanta are displacement, gentrification. How do you think art and architecture enthusiasts or events like these can bring more awareness to community needs and urgency in addressing these issues?
Well, I mean, by bringing attention to the community, in this particular community, we're going to be focusing in on a lot of the business owners and trying to help them get loans and that type of thing and support from the city. In fact, the mayor just spoke to that the other day and said he's really interested in finding ways in which you can bring funds and monies. We want the area to become mom-and-pop geared versus the big box geared. So it has a character of local farmers, local community, and that type of thing. But we need financial support to those businesses that have been there for a long time and that are developing there in a long time. So we want to keep the history of the location, because it does have a long history and a very valuable history. And we want to develop that and make it a destination point. As far as the gentrification is concerned, when people get involved, we've already told them, do not sell your house. So so we're trying to keep it like that. But we want others to come in. We want other dynamics to come in. And so I think it'll work out well. But we want it to be a community-geared, cool place. We want it to be totally different than any other place in Atlanta.
The Urban Fronts showcase, right, of the Cascade Heights Commercial District and making creative use of the storefronts in such an artistic way. Do you hope that there will be a lasting effect from this? Or, you know, is it we showcase this and then we move on to another neighborhood?
We definitely hope for a lasting effect. And I mean, the program itself tries to build partnerships within these areas of the community.
Yes. I mean, we're looking at it, and we're very happy and very enthusiastic that they have come, because it brings a spark. And when the spark is basically ignited like a fire, oh, then people get creative. They say, oh, we can do this or we can do that, and it spawns creativity. So that's the sort of thing we're working on, the spawning of creativity in the area. We're going to be focused on the arts, that type of thing. You know, there could be like a bike shop. There could be a coffee shop and all sorts of things, and a gathering spot with arts around and that sort of thing. So we're just trying to create the excitement and get people to think. So Urban Fronts brings that spark that's badly required to get people to start thinking like this. So we're very happy to have them.
Well, congratulations to you, and good luck with Urban Fronts and preserving Cascade Heights for all its beauty.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jessica Nelson is the organizer of AIA's Urban Fronts programming this year. Oscar Harris is a Cascade Heights resident and artist and renowned architect. Urban Fronts opens its pop-up gallery with art and live performances this evening at 6 at 2315 Cascade Road. The storefront creations are up through September 29th. You're listening to City Lights on WABE Atlanta.
Support for WABE comes from Kenny Leon's True Colors Theater Company, presenting Holler If You Hear Me, a fable about the urban realities of life told by the poetry and lyrics of Tupac Shakur. Now through October 8th, truecolorstheater.org.
It's easy to look at the headlines to get a sense of the news.
9 senators rejected that Senate version of the bill.
Venezuela was paralyzed by strikes and protests.
This missile can actually travel much farther than...
All Things Considered digs into the center of the story to help you really understand not just what's happening, but why. Stand with the facts. Listen every day. From 4 to 6:30, it's All Things Considered here on 90.1 WABE.
Celebrity food master and Atlanta resident Alton Brown made an exciting announcement for food lovers earlier this month. He's bringing back his show, Good Eats, that ran for 14 seasons and ended in 2011. This new version will join the Food Network schedule in 2018. You might know Brown from his other Food Network program, Cutthroat Kitchen, or from his podcast and cookbooks. We spoke with Brown last year about his most recent cookbook, Everyday Cook. He also talks a bit about Good Eats in this conversation. This Time It's Personal is the caption next to you on the cover of the book. And in the introduction, you say that even though this is your 8th book, in some ways, it feels like the first. Why?
You know, I think it's because all of the 7 books that I wrote before this were either, if not out and out, attached to a television show. They were written while I was making television shows, so they were kind of offshoots or expressions of that. And I was always trying to prove a point. I was always trying to teach scientific tenets, so to speak. This book is really just my food. These recipes were harvested mostly off of the inside of kitchen cabinet doors, where I've scrawled them in pencil, which is what I do. This is my food. The reason that I decided to do this is because I thought I've kind of reached the age where a self-portrait would not be a bad idea. And not that I'm Rembrandt or anything, but I thought, you know, I'm at an age where I think I should really do one very personal thing. And that's you know, kind of where this book came from.
Well, it's generous to share that personal stuff with your viewers and your readers and your fans.
Personal. It's also dangerous. It's also extraordinarily dangerous.
Well, has your outlook on food changed over the years? I mean, Good Eats began in 1998, and 18 years has seen a lot of change. I mean, a sea change in food programming.
Oh, not only in food programming, but in food as in its general perception by Americans. You know, it's amazing to me that we are as food aware as we are, that you know, one of the reasons that I even decided to make Good Eats was that I thought that food media was going to be a big thing. And I remember 1994, 1995, people were like, "You're crazy." And I'm like, "Nah, I got a feeling." And and still to this day, it has become a bigger phenomenon every year, which I think is really just a testament to the fact that food is kind of the connective tissue that holds people together, and not much else holds us together these days.
One of the things that has endeared you to so many is the emphasis you have on the anthropology and history of food. Mm-hmm. I would say foremost among them, my husband, who just adores watching you. You know, you inform readers and viewers in a way that simply, it's not pretentious, Alton. How do you bring together the history, the anthropology, you know, lofty stuff, but also remain unpretentious?
Here's the thing. It would be really easy for me to say that I brought anthropology into all of those episodes of Good Eats because I wanted people to grasp the significance of our food, to you know, have a deeper appreciation for where things come from and how it plays into the human story. But the truth is, that's not it at all. It comes down to the simple fact that I'm a storyteller, and I was making an entertainment. Yes, I wanted people to get off the sofa and go eat, but above all, I believe that you've got to entertain if you're going to educate. And so at the beginning and the end of the day, it was all about, I want to make a television show that's interesting. I want to tell stories that are interesting. And I really do believe that if you interest people and you engage their brains on a bunch of different levels, you make them laugh, you make them wonder, you make them curious, then you're empowering them in a lot of different ways. And I think that for a show like Good Eats, the other thing was that we always answered why. Why do you do this? Why does the potato cook this way? Why do you shop for this? The answer to those questions was to demystify and to remove that intimidation factor that so many people have. Because if you understand why you're doing things, then you can really take ownership of something. It's your food. You can make it yours. But in the end, it was about being entertaining.
Alton Brown returns to the Food Network next year with a new version of Good Eats.
Support for WABE comes from Live Nation, presenting Dead & Company at Phillips Arena on November 29th. Tickets go on sale this Saturday at 10 a.m. at livenation.com. That's Dead & Company returning to Atlanta November 29th. And from the Zuckerman Museum of Art, presenting the exhibition Medium. Everyone has a ghost story. What's yours? Reception September 16th. You can learn more at zuckerman.kennesaw.edu.
This is City Lights on WABE, where ATL meets NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thanks for joining us. Words are all around us, and our next guest wants us to consider their place in our lives. Debbie Millman is the host of the Design Matters podcast and has been named one of the most influential designers working today by Graphic Design USA. She has curated a show which is opening at the Museum of Design Atlanta this weekend. It's called Text Me, How We Live in Language. Debbie joins us in studio now. Welcome.
Hi, Lois. Thank you for having me.
Oh, great to have you here. Now, the description of the show asserts that we use text in all of its forms to define reality, emotions, and even time itself. How do characters on a page define reality for us?
Well, those characters are constructs that we've created, and they're symbols that telegraph a specific thing that we have all agreed in its meaning. So for those of us that know the alphabet, we know that A is the first letter of the alphabet. And so we have imbued meaning into these symbols, these self-created symbols. And I believe that language now is the currency of communication and has become the centerpiece of the way in which we connect. And humans are happiest, despite what we might think about a brand new TV or a brand new iPhone or a brand new car or a pair of sneakers. We are happiest when our brains are harmoniously resonating with others. And that happens through connection. And the easiest and fastest way for us to connect is through language, through agreed upon language. Now, some definitions might be different in terms of the way we interpret the word. Love has a lot of different interpretations. But if we agree on those words in our relationships, it is the way, the vehicle in which we connect with others.
When you just mentioned love, the Robert Indiana sculpture comes
Absolutely.
To mind with
yeah.
the L-O-V-E and the bright colored blocks behind them. What do you say to people who are dismissive about the way text is used today, and even more in the recent past, about text in visual art?
Well, I think that we live in a society where, for whatever reason, we tend to be very skeptical about technological change as it's happening. If you look back in time, we were extremely nervous about television and how that might eat our brains or impact our intelligence. And every time we have a technological advancement, there is some trepidation. Is this going to take over our lives? Are we going to be addicted to these things? What's really interesting about texting and the way in which we're living in our devices, people think we're addicted to the device. I actually disagree. I think that what we're really interested in, we're not in love with the device. We're in love with the connection that we get through the device. And that is, again, when our brains are resonating with others, when we feel like we are attached to others.
It's so much more unifying to hear you explain that.
Well, if you think back to 2001, 6 weeks after 9/11, the iPod was introduced. And if you look back at the commentary, the cultural commentary of that time, from 2001 until 2004, the iPod was being blamed for civilization being doomed. And we saw lots and lots and lots of headlines. And we forget this. We saw lots of headlines about how the iPod was creating an isolation nation where we were embedded in our devices and it was the cause of social anomie. And in 2005, in many ways, in response to that isolation that we were feeling in the device, we humans, created a new framework wherein we could connect in that device. And that became the most popular website on the planet. It surpassed Google that year in the number of people that were going to the website. And that website was MySpace. We figured out a way to connect in that isolated environment. And we've seen this evolution of that type of communication happen ever since. What's interesting about the notion of texting is that no one was able to predict how popular texting was going to become.
Much less that it became a verb.
Exactly. We are a species that is dependent and hardwired to connect with language. And there is this marvelous thing that happens with language. It helps us, it links our past, our present, and our future. It helps us define our reality, express the experiences of our existence. And it's the way that we are able to understand, connect, and be close to others. It's a gift.
Truly. So what is the connection between the way we communicate visually through text and the state of our culture as a whole?
Well, we're bombarded by images, and what's really interesting is how little of those images we actually can see. Our brains can actually see about 10,000 images at any given moment, but we can't comprehend that many. We can only comprehend about 40. And so we're living in a constant state of self-selection, and in many ways we see the things that we want to see. So in a lot of ways, this exhibit is about broadening what is possible to view and see. There's tension between the pieces. There's connection between the pieces. What we've tried to do is create an environment where you are able to interpret the messages and the mysteries of language in one environment.
If you're just joining us, my guest is designer, podcaster, and author Debbie Millman. We're talking about an exhibit she's curated called Text Me, How We Live in Language. She'll tell us more about that exhibit opening at MoDA in just a moment.
Support for WABE comes from Bark, helping to keep your children safer online by monitoring their text messaging, social media, and email accounts without infringing on their privacy. Learn more at bark.us. Bark. Monitor. Detect. Alert. And from the Atlanta Botanical Garden, where you can see nature in a whole new way during the Curious Garden. This unique exhibition, presented through October 29th, features a dozen surprising displays designed to make you stop, think about, and talk about plants, gardens, and nature like never before. For details, visit atlantabg.org.
We're back with Debbie Millman, host of the podcast Design Matters. She's curated an exhibit on view at MoDA this weekend titled Text Me, How We Live in Language. How do the pieces that are a part of this exhibit play with the ideas we've been talking about, Debbie?
Well, it's a little bit more political than I anticipated, but that's not a surprise, really, when thinking about the state of the culture we're currently in. I think that the condition of our visual communication in many ways reflects the condition of our culture. And so we see that it's very apparent in this show. We have an extraordinary collection of artists and designers.
Yeah,
in
the
show.
Kind of like a who's who: Basquiat, Neil Gaiman, Dave Eggers, Miranda July. You've got writers. This is not
writers, artists, designers, thinkers. We got really lucky with the collection that we have. I mean, the exhibit is really an attempt to organize, express, translate, and reflect both how we live in language and how language helps us define our lives.
Well, that must have been an exhaustive curation process.
Oh my God, Lois, it was a labor of love.
How long did you work on it?
We've been working on the show a little bit over a year. And this has been something that I've wanted to do for as far back as I can remember. And I had dinner with the executive director of MoDA, a remarkable woman named Laura Felucci, last August. And over a glass of wine, I said, hey, you know, I've had this idea for an exhibit for as far back as I can remember. And she was all ears and very excited and asked me about it. And she said, well, it sounds interesting. Put together a proposal. And I did, and the board approved it, and we set out to create this experience, which is opening on Saturday.
Debbie, where do you weigh in on emojis?
Well, I kind of like them, I have to say. They are instantly telegraphic. They express sometimes things that you might be nervous or apprehensive about expressing in a non-threatening and utterly charming way.
And so you're not discouraged about any loss or diminishing in younger people in particular in the use of language because they're relying on shortcuts. I mean, we hear so much doom and naysaying about something that really is kind of a creative act when you think about texting.
It's just an evolution of the way we're communicating. Think back to Elvis Presley or Mae West or any number of artists, designers, creators, politicians. People get really nervous when they're confronted with something that they have not seen before and don't really know how to predict. And so I think it's just an evolution of our way of inventing. And that's really exciting.
And what more do you think we can learn about how we communicate with each other from the world of design?
Well, design is a really unique discipline. It's both an art and a science. We are using language and art to communicate messages. And I think we have to be really careful with the messages that we create as designers and do the best job we can to do no harm, as Milton Glaser would say.
Do you worry about penmanship and you know, old-fashioned writing letters?
I do. But I think in the same way that radio is experiencing a renaissance, when so many people thought that radio was dead, I think that if it is a meaningful way in which we communicate and connect, it will continue.
Text Me, How We Live in Language, opens at Moda in Midtown on Sunday and will be on view through February 4th. Debbie Millman and a number of the artists with work in the show will be at the museum for an opening reception Saturday night. Debbie, congratulations. Thank you so much. This has been enlightening.
Thank you, Lois. It's really an honor to be on your show.
You've been listening to City Lights, a celebration of the arts and the ways in which we express ourselves creatively. Catch an encore broadcast tonight at 8. Tomorrow morning at 11, we'll talk with True Colors artistic director Kenny Leon about the new musical he's producing, actually a revival of Holler If You Hear Me, set to lyrics of Tupac Shakur. Our producers are Aaron Wright, Gabby Watts, and Mike Johns. Our engineer is Kevin Rinker. I'm Lois Reitzes. I love it if you'd follow me on Twitter at Lois Reitzes. That's LOISREITZES. Follow our station at WABE News. That's all for today's edition of City Lights. Here and Now comes your way next. And at 1 o'clock, it's Closer Look with Rose Scott. Thanks for joining us and for listening to member-supported 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.